Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. We're going to begin today with a rather odd grouping of subjects: wood, Mozart, and the short story. A new book has been published recently about wood. It's entitled The Age of Wood, Our Most Useful Material, and the Construction of Civilization. So a few words about the book. From the forest canopy to skyscrapers, the whole human story can be told from the perspective of wood, according to Michael Stevens in the New York Times. Biologist Roland Enos does just that in his perspective-altering new book, which points out that even the stone, iron, and bronze ages, wood was more critical to human existence. His account starts long before that, though, because our clawless fingers are inheritances from primate ancestors who needed them to swing from trees. And also because primates are just as apt to create spears and digging tools from wood as early humans were. Wood fires were even more transformative, enabling humans to cook food and to fuel the growth of their unusually large brains. Enos sometimes moves almost too quickly in his book, but the principles of every significant technology, from tree felling to shipbuilding, are described by him with a precise and almost mesmerizing detail. So here's a book I think that we can all enjoy. And then Mozart. A new book out about him. It's called The Reign of Love by Jan Swofford. You probably already know a pat version of Mozart's life story, according to Tim Page in the Washington Post. After all, audiences have been captivated for centuries by the sentimental tragedy of a doomed Wunderkind who was betrayed by his life and misunderstood by his contemporaries and laid in what is invariably described as a pauper's grave. Jan Swofford's excellent new biography offers us a slightly different picture. Though history's most celebrated child prodigy died when he was only 35, his time on earth was mostly rewarding. He was a hard worker who fulfilled his early promise. He made many friends and reveled in naughty humor. Swofford, a composer himself, has written biographies of Beethoven, Brahms, and Charles Ives, and he reports that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart stands apart in that cohort as the sanest, most gregarious, and least self-flagellating. And then we have a few words about the master of the short story. This was George Saunders. Few writers understand the mechanics of the short story better than George Saunders, according to Carol Goodwin in the Wall Street Journal recently. A gentle giant of American letters, the 62-year-old has been teaching creative writing at Syracuse since shortly after his debut collection, 1996's Civil War Land in Bad Decline, which won wide acclaim. His unique perspective on storycraft springs in part from his background in engineering, which trained him to value ruthless efficiency in pursuit of any goal, including the goal of grabbing and holding a reader's interest in his new book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, which grew out of a class that he teaches at Syracuse University. He deconstructs stories by Tolstoy, by Chekhov, and other Russian masters, and uses plenty of chatty language alongside orderly charts and tables that illuminate the author's methods. So here are three books that I heartily recommend to my readers. I think you will enjoy them. Now it's important for us to look at the way to make a more accurate world map and use the flip side of the page too. I'm looking at the New York Times, Tuesday, March 9th this year, and there's an extremely interesting article here about world maps and their accuracy. And my background as a geographer drew me to this immediately. Most of the world maps you've seen are past their prime. The Mercator was devised by a Flemish cartographer in 1569. The Winkel Tripel, which is the map style favored by National Geographic, dates to 1921. And the Dymaxion map, hyped by the architect Buckminster Fuller, debuted in 1943. Enter a brash new world map, which is vying for global domination. The map-making game can sometimes grow stale when top competitors are stuck on the same old strategy, said J. Richard Gott, who is an astrophysicist at Princeton. And he had previously mapped the entire universe. We were sort of reaching the limit of what it could do, he said. If you wanted any significant breakthrough, you had to use a new idea. Dr. Galt came up with just that. Make the map double-sided, like a vinyl record. Put the northern hemisphere on the top side and the southern hemisphere on the bottom, or vice versa. Or to put it differently, you could deflate the 3D Earth into two dimensions. No flat map of our round world can be perfect, of course, but you need to peel off Earth's skin, then pin it down. This mathematical taxidermy introduces distortions. If you have a Mercator projection on your classroom walls, for example, you may have grown up thinking that Greenland is the size of Africa. Well, it's not even close. Or that Alaska is bigger than Mexico. Come on now, that's not true. Shapes also change in map projections. Distances vary according to map projections, and straight lines curve. Researchers developed a scoring system to sum up these different kinds of error. The Winkel Tripel beat out other major contenders, but one big source of distortion persisted. A mathematical incision often running from pole to pole down the Pacific Ocean. And the resulting shape can never again be stretched and pulled back into the unbroken surface of a sphere. Dr. Gott's new kind of double-sided map, which is crafted with David Goldberg of Drexel University and Robert Vanderbilt, a mathematician at Princeton, skips the topological violence entirely. The map they've made simply continues over the edge. You could stretch a string over the side. An ant could walk there. Without any cut, the map's distortion score blows all the other maps out of the water. So if you like maps, remember that you can read this brief article, which is illustrated with this new projection in the New York Times on Tuesday, March the 9th of this year. If you're looking for the best protein, here are some plants that are suggested for that purpose. Substituting dietary plant protein for animal protein, even in modest amounts, could significantly reduce the risk of disease and premature death, a new study suggests. Researchers gathered diet data from 102,000 women whose average age was 63 and followed their health for an average of 18 years. Over the course of the study, there were about 26,000 deaths. After controlling for a variety of other factors, the researchers found that compared with the 1/5 of the women who consumed the least plant protein, the 1/5 who consumed the most were 9% less likely to die prematurely from any cause, 12% less likely to die of cardiovascular disease, and 21% less likely to die from dementia-related causes. The study, in the Journal of the American Heart Association, found that nuts were a particularly good and convenient source of plant protein. They calculated that if a woman replaced just 2 ounces a day of red meat or dairy products with 2 ounces of nuts, she would lower her risk for premature death by about 11%. I hate the idea of telling people to remove a certain food completely from their diet, said the senior author of the study, who is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Iowa. It's not realistic, he said. It only discourages people from making changes. Modest substitution is the key. And I want to emphasize that it's not just protein that's important, but where the protein is coming from. So we can think about that as we wait for the next topic. You may think this is too funny to include today, but I couldn't resist. It's entitled, "In This Case, A Bird in the Hand is Worth 170 Years in the Bushes." And you're probably wondering what has gone wrong here. Well, what might be Asia's longest missing bird just came out of hiding. And for the first time in 170 years, a black-browed babbler has been found in Indonesia. The discovery of the muted black, gray, and chestnut brown bird solves what one birding guide called one of the great enigmas of Indonesian ornithology. When we actually got confirmation of the identification, I did a little prayer and bowed down to celebrate, said the ornithologist and the author of a paper about the new species. Ornithologists described black-browed babblers around 1850, after the collection of the only known specimen, but it was mislabeled as having come from Java rather than Borneo. But after that mix-up was cleared up, the bird remained elusive. In 2016, however, a new bird-watching group in Indonesian Borneo reached out to local people to mine their expertise. And last October, two of the local men managed to catch one of the birds in the forest in South Kalimantan, which is one of Indonesia's provinces in Borneo, and text photos to a BW member. And so, I would never have thought that. Maybe you think we babble on this show, but this is really babbling today. And now a serious subject, the connection between cancer and having a drink. Experts say even moderate alcohol consumption increases the odds of getting the disease. When the pandemic struck last year, many Americans rushed to stock up on alcohol, causing retail sales of wine and beer and liquor to surge. But the uptick in sales was a worrying sign for health experts who are focused on cancer prevention. In recent years, a growing number of medical and public health groups have introduced public awareness campaigns which warn people to drink with caution, noting that alcohol is the third leading preventable cause of cancer, behind tobacco and obesity. In October, the American Society for Clinical Oncology, which represents many of the nation's top cancer doctors, along with the American Institute for Cancer Research, the American Public Health Association, and five other groups, called on the federal government to add a cancer warning to alcohol labels, saying there was strong scientific consensus that alcohol can cause several types of cancer, including breast and colon cancers. While medical experts have long recognized alcohol as a risk factor for various cancers, such as mouth, throat, voice box, esophagus, and liver, a survey conducted in 2017 with 4,000 American adults found that fewer than a third recognized alcohol as a risk factor for cancer. Other countries are stepping up public health efforts to rein in alcohol consumption as well. The European Union, which has some of the highest levels of drinking in the world, announced this year that it planned to put a new health warning on alcohol and to explore new taxes and restrictions on the marketing of alcoholic beverages as part of a $5 billion plan to reduce cancer rates. In France, the government announced that it would issue new warnings and policies to discourage heavy drinking as part of a 10-year plan to tackle cancer, which is the country's leading cause of death. The ongoing pandemic underscores the urgency of these efforts as stress, lockdowns, and economic uncertainty continue to take their toll. In the past year, U.S. hospitals have reported an increase in admissions for hepatitis, for liver failure, and other alcoholic-related diseases. A study in the journal Psychiatry Research found that in the first 6 months of the lockdown, alcohol abuse rose most sharply among people who lost their jobs or who were confined to their homes because of shelter-in-place restrictions. The pandemic has also made it easier for people working from home to drink throughout the day without fear of colleagues noticing. Today is opening day. Major League Baseball begins anew. We're hoping for the full 162-game season. I was thinking about some questions that people often have about baseball. And one of the questions that come up from time to time, you wonder why successful baseball managers are difficult to find. Every American male is convinced that he can outdo the professionals in three different endeavors. One, running a hotel. Two, grilling a steak. And three, managing a Major League Baseball team. But why is it so difficult to find just the right manager for any given team? When asked this question at one of his last press conferences, four-time manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, Danny Murtaugh, responded very forthrightly, and he said, "Why, certainly I'd like to have that fellow who hits a home run every time at bat, who strikes out every batter when he's pitching, and who throws strikes to any base when he's playing the outfield, and who's always thinking about two innings ahead, just what he'd do to baffle the other team. Ask any manager who wouldn't want a guy like that playing for him. The only trouble is to get him to put down his cup of beer and come down out of the stands to do these things." Another question that sometimes arises now is that why are current baseball franchises increasing in value at not only rapid rates, but alarming rates? Few financial investments have been made as profitable for investors as ownership of a Major League Baseball team. There are several reasons for this. Lucrative contracts generated between television networks and teams. Deals with Fox, TBS, and ESPN, for example, have generated about $1.5 billion a year and will continue to do so through this year. In line with this, local television contracts with regional sports networks add, according to some analysis, hundreds of millions of dollars to the balance sheets of teams serving highly populated areas of the country. Then, fans throughout the country have subscribed to regional coverage of their favorite teams. And finally, Major League Baseball has enjoyed a relative peace era in terms of negotiations with labor. And since 1994, that was the last year of a strike lockout, there has been more or less smooth sailing. So those are some of the reasons that the current franchises are increasing in value, even if they're losers. And now, my friends, I think it's about time that we finish up for the day. Dan Dillman asking you to be safe out there. Take care of yourself. Wear your mask. Some people suggest wearing two is a good idea. Keep your social distances where necessary. And have a good day. It's a nice sunny day for the first day of the new baseball season. So tune in next time for a little of this, a little of that. I'll be waiting for you. I enjoy having you around. Please tune in. Good day. See you then.